the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. Sir Keir Starmer will say there is light at the end of the tunnel as he addresses his first Labour conference as Prime Minister. But he will warn of a shared struggle through short-term pressures. In his speech, he will talk about a goal of creating a Britain built to last. Our political correspondent Ian Watson is at the conference in Liverpool. He says Sir Keir will set out a vision for the country.
There'll be a smattering of specific policies around skills, for example, and more he'll be saying on welfare reform, because he has to obviously identify savings in the budget in order to put investment elsewhere. But we'll get a little bit more of that detail. And I think there was a worry that here's a party with a big majority, and yet there's a bit of a cloud hanging over the conference, people feeling a little bit gloomy and worried indeed that businesses and others might feel gloomy and not give the country the investment and growth that it needs.
Thousands of families have been fleeing their homes in Lebanon after authorities say almost 500 people were killed yesterday in Israeli airstrikes. Israel says it killed a number of Hezbollah fighters and hit around 13,000 targets. The White House says President Biden will present concrete plans for ending the crisis in Lebanon at the UN General Assembly in New York this week. These people in Beirut are very worried.
The thing that's happening is far away from humanity, and this shouldn't be happening.
If a total war happens, we should stand as Lebanese people together, regardless of our political affiliations, because at the end of the day, our country is getting bombed.
Zombie-style knives and machetes are banned in England and Wales from today as a new law comes into force. It's now illegal to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives, often used by criminal gangs. A consumer group is calling for a public inquiry into the collapse of the funeral company Safe Hands Plans Limited. Almost 50,000 people lost their money they paid into a funeral plan when the company went bust in 2022. At the time, the industry was unregulated, but funeral providers are now required the approval of the Financial Conduct Authority to operate. Margaret and David Fee invested almost £6,000 in their funeral plans. They said the collapse has had a big impact on their lives.
We're not getting into debt, but there's nothing left.
It gets you inside through worry. That doesn't help your health. And I say all these things add up eventually. Well, sometimes you think, oh, is it worth carrying on? But you've got to.
Props, clothing and furniture from the set of the sitcom Friends have been sold in an auction marking 30 years since the show was first aired. The top-selling item was an official reproduction of the Central Perk Cafe's orange sofa, where the group often gathered. It sold for around £22,000. The weather, any rain in the southeast will clear. Elsewhere, it will be cloudy with spells of rain. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past five.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this isn't all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts next Tuesday on BBC iPlayer.
Wake Up to Money from BBC Five Live.
Hello, welcome. It is Wake Up to Money. In an exclusive interview with this programme, we're going to hear from the boss of Superdry, who doesn't mince his words when it comes to that Chinese fast fashion giant, Shein.
A complete environmental disaster. We're allowing somebody to come in and be a tax avoider.
Plenty more from my chat with Julian Dunkerton in the next hour. Also this morning, are you feeling like there's light at the end of the tunnel? The Prime Minister thinks there is, and we'll dissect the Chancellor's party conference speech from yesterday as well. And after months of uncertainty, looks like it could be a better day for Everton fans as the Premier League club agrees a takeover deal with new owners.
Wake Up to Money with Sean Farrington.
Good morning to you. It is Wake Up to Money on BBC Five Live. It's Tuesday morning, the 24th of September, and it is just after 5 o'clock, reassuringly. I'm Sean Farrington. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. 85058, of course, is the number to be using to get in touch. And particularly as you listen to Julian Dunkerton talk about the world of fashion, you might have views on Superdry. Maybe you were big fans of it when it was booming as a £2 billion company. Do you still keep an eye on it now as it's way, way, way smaller? But Julian Dunkerton's got plans to try and turn the corner with the business, and he's got plenty of views on the wider world of fashion, what's impacting British businesses at the moment. Are you one of those that uses Shein, the fast fashion Chinese retailer, where you can, you know, get small items that don't cost very much at all at the drop of a hat, flown over from China just for you? And many customers seem to be very happy with that. It's being valued at a lot of money. It wants to list on our stock markets here in the UK. It's being reported. So there's big questions for those in charge of our financial sector here in the UK, those in charge of policy, of which companies can set up base on our stock markets and try and raise investment and get expertise here in London, in the UK as well. Is that the right thing? Is it the right kind of business that we should be looking to attract? So there's a big chat to be had about that, and plenty to get into with the ongoing Labour Party conference as well. I've got Will Corby with me, Director of Coffee and Social Impact at Pact Coffee, supplying coffee online, in store. They work with 200 farms in countries right around the world, and surprisingly, it's where you get your coffee from: Congo, China, Kenya, Brazil. Morning to you, Will.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How's the world of coffee this morning?
Fantastic. I've got a good mug here to keep me going.
Oh, have you? Good. Yeah, I've got my sort of thermosy type thing, so I can keep mine warm throughout the show. It just about survives the hour, so that is good. A good start. Wouldn't expect anything less from a coffee boss, Will. It's been a bit of a talking point the last few weeks about the rising price of coffee for one reason or another. Are you still feeling like you're having to try and keep a lid on passing on cost pressures to customers, or have they calmed down now for you and you know this is how much it's going to cost you pretty much this year, and this is what you can charge those arriving in your stores and buying online?
Yeah, it's been a really volatile time for commodity coffee costs over the past couple of years. In general, we're talking about at Pact buying the best coffee on the planet, so we're always operating with quite a significant buffer above that that commodity market price. So we are somewhat cushioned from those changes.
Because your starting point is higher, is that sort of what you mean?
It's so significantly higher. You know, we're set up as a business to sell people the best coffee on the planet and use that as a way to do good, to pay farmers in rural poor communities really great prices so that they can lead much better lives.
But when you say you've got a buffer, is that because your almost starting price point for a customer might be higher, or your overall costs might be higher than those who are really trying to push, you know, the profit margins as far as they can take them?
Yeah, so our average green coffee price was last year 40% above the fair trade base rate, best base rate, and significantly above the commodity price. And what we pay each year is significantly above that. Obviously, there is some inflationary pressure from that commodity price increase, but the relationships we have and the great coffee we source it comes in at only a fraction more expensive. So we're feeling it, but we're definitely happy to see higher prices being paid to farmers around the world.
And what do you make of, you know, the mood music out of the Labour Party conference this week? Waking up this morning, you'll be seeing pictures of Keir Starmer ahead of his speech later today. I think the speech is today, certainly coming up at the conference. But the headlines, light at the end of the tunnel. Does it feel to you like you're in that situation?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of there are a lot of smiling faces there yesterday, pointing at cameras, cheesy grins. I think, you know, definitely a change in the a change in tone. And I guess, you know, it's five weeks tomorrow. We've got the budget, and there was a great line I read in one of the BBC articles: "Will the bite be less harsh than the bark?" I think perhaps there's some word work at play there.
Interesting. Yep. I'm our economics editor. So that was a very interesting piece about what on earth. Have you got that date etched in the diary for the budget, Will? Could it have an impact on the decision making you have, the prospects for your growth over the months to come?
We'll certainly be watching closely. You know, I think especially around potential for rate changes for small business. You know, when we talk about coffee in the UK, often, you know, you jump straight to thinking about businesses like Starbucks. But actually, for every high street where there's one Starbucks, there's probably five or six other small businesses, often small family businesses, trying to earn a living. And they're the kind of businesses we have relationships with. So we really want to see them on a footing to be able to do really well.
Let's have a look back as well. I've got Emma Wall with me on the show this morning, Head of Investment Analysis and Research at Hargreaves Lansdown. Morning, Emma.
Good morning, Sean.
Those watching the numbers closely and wondering what exactly might be in the budget, paying particular attention to what the Chancellor had to say at conference yesterday. At the conference, Rachel Reeves standing by cuts to winter fuel payments for pensioners. She told the conference hall in Liverpool she'll make hard but fair choices. Let's have a little listen to her. She also said no return to austerity, calling for iron discipline, relentless focus on the priorities of British people.
Stability is the crucial foundation on which all of our ambitions will be built. The essential precondition for business to invest with confidence and for families to plan for the future. So we will make the choices necessary to secure our public finances and fix the foundations for lasting growth.
So, Emma, what does that mean? Have you taken away anything more from Rachel Reeves' speech yesterday when you sort of tried to read between the lines? Because I noticed the headline in The Guardian this morning, PM vows to end gloom as Labour seeks to lift spending restrictions. And in The Times, you go inside, Reeves in borrowing hint, we can't always say no to ideas. What does that mean?
What does it actually mean? Because I think for those of us who love analysing this stuff, so you and I, the Labour Party conference, and indeed any party conference, is quite interesting. But actually, for most individuals, the most important date is going to be that budget. It's going to be that end of October, because there wasn't really any specific policy commitments in this week. As expected, you know, normally you don't get any big mic drop moments in party conference. Party conference mostly is about setting the tone, but it was definitely more optimistic than it has been recently. And there's that hint, as you say, that Rachel Reeves is considering changing how the government's fiscal rules are calculated, which seems a bit like finding billions of pounds down the back of a sofa. But it's about making sure that our balance sheet as a country reflects the benefits of public spending and not just the debt, which then in turn could free up spending. She called out in particular, you know, thinking about things like HS2, which weren't a success, but looking at public spending and how that can have public benefit.
Let's talk briefly about fiscal rules, Emma. It's a phrase we hear a lot, and we are probably going to hear plenty more in the run-up to the budget, because this is rules that the government set themselves, and the Conservative Party, when they were in government, set themselves these rules, and Labour said it's going to, at the moment, continue with them, where the targets that they're setting themselves are linked to the size of our debt as a nation, aren't they? And it's not some other, you know, wider body or an independent regulator. It's not the Bank of England or, you know, the International Monetary Fund who says you need to abide by these rules. Mm. It's the same person, effectively, the Chancellor, who's saying these are my rules and they're restricting me from borrowing.
Yeah, and Labour was very, very strong in its language and its manifesto. So it said our fiscal rules are non-negotiable and will apply to every decision taken by a Labour government. Ultimately, they committed that the budget must move into balance, which means revenues and debt must match, i.e. they're not going to borrow any more than is coming in. They're going to be sensible. But the manifesto was obviously written before they discovered this much talked about black hole and before they got their hands and their eyes on the kind of weeds of the situation. So it'd be interesting to see how they managed to balance that manifesto pledge with also this pledge to instill economic growth, to spend on things like the green economy, to support those who are most vulnerable within our society. So there's a definite and difficult balancing act to be had.
And Will, how easy is it, or how difficult is it, to figure out if borrowing for a certain investment, particularly if it's about infrastructure, for example, which a lot of people are looking at one way or another, whether it's rail lines or nuclear power stations, or there may be projects local to everybody listening here that they think this needs to be built, figuring out whether borrowing money at today's interest rates to do that stuff is worth it.
It's a tricky one. you know, I think you can follow that that thread investment in public infrastructure to growth, and it's all very logical. But we've seen over the past 5-10 years the problem HS2 has created in terms of that in terms of spend. I think it seems like a logical conclusion to me, but I'm not sure where you can derive the math to necessarily prove it.
Well, yeah, quite. And I very much appreciated that sigh before the thinking, because I think that summed up exactly the debate of, you know, what can be done, what can't be done, maybe what previous chancellors have been mulling, and this one is as well, about that, you know, when we look around us and we use the infrastructure every single day and we all know where we'd like to have better services and better stuff in place. You might work in the NHS and feel that every day, be a patient and see some of those things in recent times. But where is the money coming from for that? Do you wait until you're actually producing more as a country and producing more tax and then spend that? But if you wait, will that day ever come? That's the debate at the moment, and one we will have very much in the run-up to the budget as well. Right, it is 16 minutes past five, so just after 5:15. Let's get the weather forecast for the day. Here's Chris Fawkes at the BBC Weather Centre.
Hello. Well, we saw some severe flooding and disruption yesterday, particularly focused on the South Midlands. Oxfordshire hit especially hard, and it was here where we had nearly 100 millimetres rain, about a month and a half's worth of rainfall in the space of a day. That's causing the damage. Now, looking at the weather picture today, it's a much calmer kind of day. OK, there's a few dribs and drabs of light patches of rain left over across East Anglia and South East England to start off with, but that's going to clear out of the way. Quite a lot of cloud, a few mist and fog patches around first thing in the morning, but I think as we go on through the morning, most of England and Wales will see sunny spells break through. In the afternoon, just a few showers coming into the northwest of both England and Wales. Most, though, should have a dry day. In Northern Ireland, it's a day of sunny spells and showers. And finally, the forecast for Scotland. Here we've got a cold front pushing southwards, bringing a spell of rain, followed by showers into the afternoon across northern areas. That cold front really dropping the temperatures. So for most of the UK, 14 to 18 degrees, your top temperature. But for northern Scotland, just 10 degrees. And the colder weather will spread to the rest of Scotland and Northern Ireland for tomorrow. Chris Fawkes, 5 Live Weather.
Now, I am delighted to say we are joined in the studio here in Salford by our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett. Theo, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
Thank you so much for being here with us. In a couple of days' time, we're going to be hearing plenty more of you on Wake Up to Money. So really looking forward to that. Welcome to the gang. I mean, we spoke to you a gazillion times on this show before. But as you were in the area, we like to drag in anybody with an ounce of expertise. And we often give a shout out to the Theo Leggett Twitter feed for anybody following the aviation industry, Boeing in particular. And as, you know, not luck would have it so much, but we wake up this morning and there's a development in the Boeing saga. Where are we at now?
There is indeed. Well, for people who need a reminder, Boeing workers, some 30,000 of them in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, that's the Seattle region and Portland, Oregon, the area where planes like the 737 MAX and the 777 are made, they've been on strike for about 10 days now. And it's about a contract renegotiation, a contract for the next 4 years that will dictate how much these people earn. Boeing came forward with an offer. It was heartily recommended by their union, and en masse, the workforce rejected it by 95%. And so they've been on strike ever since. Now, talks have been going on. This week, they broke down. But off the back of that, Boeing's come forward with a new pay offer. It's increased what it's offering its workers from a 25% pay increase, which was what it was in its original offer, to 30%, improved retirement benefits, and a bonus of $6,000 just for signing up to all of this. So they've said this is their last and final offer, that it has to be voted on by end of business Pacific time on Friday. So that's about 7 a.m. our time. And that it needs to be voted on here and now. The union has turned around and said, hang on a minute, we didn't negotiate this. Mm. We think it's wrong. They've described it as a blatant show of disrespect to the union membership and to the bargaining process, and said people shouldn't vote for this, that it's the wrong way of doing things. So we've gone from a situation where just about 2 weeks ago, you had Boeing and the trade union both putting forward an offer to the union membership saying, this is a great deal. We think it's brilliant. The union said it was probably the best deal they'd ever negotiated. That was rejected by the workforce. We've now got Boeing coming forward with a better offer and the union saying it's out of order. And in the meantime, it's not entirely clear where union members are going. There's clearly been a substantial breakdown in trust between Boeing and the employees on the shop floor. The union doesn't seem to know what its position is in all of this. And we've had a response from Boeing as well, saying they've bargained in good faith with the International Association of Machinists. That's the union since formal negotiations began in March. And they've got every right to present this offer and share details with employees. So it's another twist in the saga of a big breakdown in industrial relations between Boeing and its workers, which is hampering production of the planes that Boeing needs to get on the market.
Yeah, and we've heard like Michael O'Leary, Ryanair, saying I might not get all the planes I need for next summer and further down the line and the impact he can have. But I just wonder, Theo, you said the development in the saga regarding these negotiations with unions and workers, but there seems to have been so many sagas for Boeing. What's your sort of take on where Boeing overall is at now, safety-wise? Those who are in charge, is it going to be able to anytime soon just get back to making planes and delivering them?
Well, Boeing has a new chief executive, Kelly Ortberg. He came into the job just over a month ago. I think he's got a huge task on his hand because he's got to appease regulators. He's got to sort out things on the shop floor. In the factory floor, things have been going wrong. Quality control has slipped. Safety standards have slipped. And if you talk to people within the company, it's safety culture isn't what it should be. So he's got to sort that out. He needs the workforce to be on side for that. But at the moment, the workforce very clearly are not on side. They voted 96% for a strike.
Right. Well, Lisa, give you plenty more to talk about with Boeing for a bit yet. Theo, thank you. Good to talk to you. Look forward to hearing plenty more as you're in the hot seat for Wake Up to Money on Thursday morning.
I'll be back on Thursday.
Rest up before then. Theo Leggett, our international business correspondent. Will Corby, the boss of Packed Coffee, who's with us this morning. Well, we're about to hear a bit more of an interview I've done with the boss of Superdry. So this is the clothing label that, it boomed on the high street at one point, became a nearly £2 billion business and then went through a lot of struggles. It's still got plenty of branded stores around the world, but is nowhere near the size it once was. But it's been interesting catching up with Julian Dunkerton, who was the founder there. I wonder, Will, there seems to be a plethora of, walking to a bookshop or if you want to look at podcasts that are around. So many podcasts about, running a business, generating a business, being a founder on Instagram, you follow certain entrepreneurs who are very much putting, their life on show and telling you how it's done. Do you follow others, Will, when you're sort of part of a business that is, relatively new and wanting to grow? Do you look elsewhere? I wonder where you get your stuff from.
Yeah, I think we're living in a golden age of founders and CEO community. There's so many podcasts, so many leaderships elements you can listen to. I think you've got to be very careful, cautious about taking advice from every angle, because I think there's an element of PR,
yes,
for individuals involved in it. But I think the exposure that we can get from some of the greatest kind of leaders in business at the moment is really exciting.
Well, let's have a listen to Julian Dunkerton, founded Superdry more than 20 years ago. And he has told us on Wake Up to Money that the Chinese fast fashion retailer Shein is exploiting tax loopholes, being an environmental disaster. You might wake up and this morning may have already seen the headlines on the BBC website. Superdry boss says Shein allowed to dodge tack. Now, of course, Superdry has got those distinctive Japanese-style T-shirts once worn by Hollywood actors, a company worth a lot of money at one point, but popularity's fallen back. It was listed on the London Stock Exchange for nearly 15 years and decided to not be on the London Stock Exchange anymore. Different ways of being able to buy shares in the company is valued at less than £10 million at the minute. But it does have 740 branded stores around 60 countries elsewhere. So Julian Dunkerton talking a lot about trying to turn Superdry dry round. He did leave for a brief period in 2018 and came back. He did want to talk about Shein, though. The Chinese fast fashion giant reportedly in talks itself over a massive listing on the London Stock Exchange. Could be worth £50 billion. It's an extremely popular business, isn't it, Shein? Younger consumers, we've talked about it a lot before, can be big fans of it, but it's been criticised over its environmental credentials. There's plenty to play. We're going to start with Julian Duggeton telling me he's pretty optimistic about Superdry's recent performance.
Do you know what? We've had the best start to a season I think we've had probably for about 15 years. It's actually quite exciting at the moment. We are outperforming the BRC in a way that we haven't done for, over a decade, I think. So when you talk about outperforming,
it's compared to your peers across the high street.
So last week, I think we were 35% above our peers. So a great place to be for the start of a season.
What do you think's driving that? When you look at how your customers are spending and what they're doing now that they weren't doing 6 months ago or a year ago?
I think there's a couple of things. There's been a lot of self-help. So I've been able to really get my hands dirty since we delisted. It's given me more time to do my job properly, which is get out to the stores, get the option count correct, get the journey through the stores in a better place, get the e-com imagery right. And then fashion is cyclical. And it would seem that we're very much appealing to teenagers again, which we haven't done for a long time. So that's a great place to be.
And is that almost, not to downplay the efforts of everybody at Superdry and every retailer, but when it's cyclical, can it be out of your hands sometimes, whether people like, Superdry, people do know what that is since it hit our shops all those years ago. It is very visible and people get what that you're trying to do, I guess. But does that disappear and come back without you doing much about it sometimes?
No, not at all. So what it means is there's a fashion moment that your brand is able to create products that are suitable for a particular market and for a particular age group. And, the 16 to 18 year old sort of very environmentally conscious, they reject whatever the generation above was doing, or that their older brothers, older sisters, and so they are looking again for something that they can adopt that their older peers weren't adopting. So it really, it's a great opportunity for us. But no, it doesn't happen without effort and work.
No, quite. I mean, how does the business compare now to the very height of, well, let's say if we use the value of the business at its very height, and it's almost most famous, its most successful moments, because you founded it 20 odd years ago, and then you left the business 2018, you came back a year or so later. What's the difference between the business now and the business when it was absolutely booming?
I think when you're in a boom phase, what you're doing is replicating something that's been successful many times. And when you get to a point of having to reinvent yourself, then you're not in a replicating kind of situation. You're it's a different part of the business cycle, if you like. So I feel like we're at a point now where we're starting to see growth again. So, we're a different business, and it's very easy to replicate something over and over and over and over if it's very successful. But then that reinvention is the important part to make sure that you are here in 10 years' time from now.
How are you a different business now? Because I see you've just done a deal with Next, for example, so some children's wear stuff will be on its platform. When you were just opening stores as much as you could all those years ago, that feels quite different, leaning on another retailer, a rival retailer.
No, not right. They're very much a partner. So partnerships are the name of the game. I mean, wholesale has always been part of our business, and relationships with third parties has always been part of our business. So that isn't competition at all. Look, the world's changed fundamentally. I mean, in 2010, this was a rollout of physical stores with some e-com. And now, of course, it's about, a broader range, having to target different areas of the market and having different partnerships and relationships to deliver your brand to a consumer. it is that understanding of how the world has changed to make sure that you're, you know, front and centre in front of the consumer in the way that they want to shop.
I reckon if I'd have been talking to you in 2019 when you returned to the business, yeah, and, you know, and I see quotes from the time where you're describing it as a renaissance moment for the business, I think you might have had a very similar energy to the one you have right now and positivity, but it didn't play out that way. Why not?
Well, I mean, let's face it, COVID played a massive part of that. That was a very difficult part to turn a business around. And I've got to say, being in a, you know, a situation where I inherited a lot of falling knives. I mean, I had a huge amount of stock trapped in warehouses around the world, which I was not aware of. Things evolved in or disclosed in front of me as I, you know, after I came back, you know, the real problems of the business. And then throw on top of that COVID, which was a very difficult place to navigate through. And dare I say, you know, being a public company in a turnaround situation is not as easy as being an entrepreneur in a turnaround situation.
Interesting. There's a few things in there. I mean, just that what you were returning to. I mean, yeah, you weren't gone that long. Do you look back and think the way you were running it before you left was teeing up those problems?
Well, no, you have to remember that essentially I hadn't been CEO for about 3.5 years. I handed the reins over to somebody to be CEO, and that's when the changes started to happen. But they weren't visible until sort of 2018, when they were suddenly becoming visible to me.
Was it an error to hand over those chief executive reins while still having such an interest in the business?
I have to say it was. For me personally, that was the wrong decision.
What do you think led to you doing that? When you look back now, for a boss to say that was a wrong decision, I wonder what else somebody could learn from where you went wrong there.
I did it for very personal reasons. I did it because the next phase of our growth was very much involving huge amount of international travel to China, to America. And I'm a father as well as a CEO, and I just didn't want to really do all that physical travel and not be a father.
When you do look forward now for, you know, yeah, what you describe as being more of an exciting time for the business, do you still sort of in the back of your mind look back at those, the peak moments of Superdry to many, to shoppers it would be, when you had the likes of David Beckham, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet spotted in your clothes? You sort of thinking, I want to get back to that point again?
Well, look, obviously, when you're going back into growth and a whole new generation of people are discovering you for the first time, it opens up a completely different kind of influencer, if you like, and influencers have changed. It isn't just about celebrities anymore. It is about influencers. And I think we had 1,000 TikTok creator posts in the last sort of 8 weeks with 34 million reach. So, you know, we're changing. It's the same but different, if you see what I mean. I mean, before it was, of course, a massive celebrity being picked up by a newspaper, and now it's TikTok or Instagram, or, you know, it's a different way of marketing, but it's the same. It's the same, but new.
It sounds like it just even in recent months, something has changed in the business. So I just wanted to play something. It was just a few months ago, so there may have been changes in recent months. But I was talking to Peter Williams about the wider retail sector back in April. He was chairman of Superdry between 2019, 2021. This is what he had to say at the time.
This is an illustration of a brand that is probably not as cool as it used to be. Teenagers don't necessarily want to shop where their parents used to shop. And there is this natural culling of fashion brands that goes on.
So that was one small comment on Superdry in a wider interview. Is there something in that about not being as cool as you once were?
Well, look, I mean, it's cool to whom, and at what point are you in the cycle? So if we're suddenly growing again with teenagers, suddenly we're becoming cool again. I mean, bless Peter. Yeah. I don't want to speak ill of somebody who's probably been out of the industry properly for a long time. I can see it on the ground, and you don't deliver 65% like-for-like growth in stores if you're not on a renaissance.
And this is why I'm interested in these last few months, particularly. What is it that is going on? Because It sounds like you're learning a lot as you go. If all of a sudden, you know, TikTok is having a big impact, that world didn't remotely exist when Superdry was on its first sort of upwards curve. What kind of boss are you now then?
Look, this is not about self-reflection. This is about where is your consumer and what are they doing and what do they want? And actually, I think within the public company constraints, it was quite difficult to be that kind of boss. And now I'm very much, look, if we're doing a bad job representing the brand to the consumer, then we have to change that and be better. And whether that's in a wholesale environment, in a third party store, whether that's on e-com, you know, we are making a difference to how we turn up to a consumer, whichever touch point you come to us.
That was Julian Dunkerton. Plenty more to come from Julian on Wake Up to Money. Stay with us for that. It's 5:35.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Bring you the news headlines very shortly, but let's get the sports headlines with Shabnam Unisjul.
Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club, subject to approval from the Premier League, the Football Association and the Financial Conduct Authority. Manchester City fans are anxiously waiting on news of midfielder Rodri, who was substituted during the first half of Sunday's 2-2 draw against Arsenal. It's feared he could miss the rest of the season after initial tests showed damage to his ACL. City's 3 defeats last season came without the Spain international in the team. The League Cup tie between AFC Wimbledon and Newcastle has been moved to St James's Park next Tuesday after the London club's stadium was affected by flooding. The third round match was due to be played at the Cherry Red Records Stadium on Tuesday night. 4 games are still on. 5 Live will have commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. Leeds United have announced plans to modernise and improve Elland Road. Part of the proposal is to increase capacity from just over 37,500 to around 53,000. The League Two Lancashire derby between Fleetwood and Morecambe ended in a 2-2 draw. And in cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years as they held on to beat Somerset by 15 runs. And on 5 Sports Extra on Tuesday from 12:15, you can hear England against Australia in the 3rd One Day International. England are 2-0 down in the series heading into that match at Chesterley Street.
And you can have the news headlines now. The tech gremlins have resolved themselves. Sir Keir Starmer will say there is light at the end of this tunnel as he makes his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister later. He'll warn, though, of a shared struggle through short-term pressures. Thousands of families have been fleeing their homes in Lebanon after authorities there say almost 500 people were killed yesterday in Israeli airstrikes. Israel says it killed a number of Hezbollah fighters and hit around 13,000 targets. And zombie-style knives and machetes are banned in England and Wales from today as a new law comes into force.
Coming up this week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 8, 5 Live has commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham. Today there's ball-by-ball coverage of England against Australia in the 3rd ODI on 5 Sports Extra.
And tonight at 8, Aston Villa travel to Wycombe in the EFL Cup.
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds. Wake Up to Money with Sean Farrington.
Good morning to you. It is Wake Up to Money on BBC 5 Live. It's not far off, 20 to 6. This morning, let's crack on with hearing more from my interview with the founder and chief executive of Superdry, Julian Dunkerton. Now, just a few months ago, the business was on the London stock market where people could buy shares in it. You could use your stocks and shares ISA if you wanted. It was publicly available for people to do that, but they decided to come away from the London Stock Exchange. The value of the business had fallen from £1.8 billion back in early 2018. It was then worth less than £4 million. I asked Julian Dunkerton how he reflected on the business's time listing on the stock markets in London.
Well, do you know what? Actually, it was exactly the right decision at the time. It valued the business at a higher level than any other routes to putting capital into the business. And while we had a simple business model, it was a great way to allow investors to share in our growth. So it worked incredibly well. It started to work less well when we had to really do some heavy lifting and grafting. And, you know, that was harder. There's a sense that potentially every decision has to be verified by a third party. And when you're actually having to be nimble on your feet, you can't verify every decision by a consultant or so on. So when you're in a turnaround, you need to be nimble. And that's what we are again.
But is there something about being a founder still running a business that is now listed on the stock exchange with everybody sticking their oar in? Because you have to do certain things every few months. You've got new investors demanding different questions of you.
Look, I mean, the first 8 years were hugely successful. We were one of the most successful listings for a long, long, long time. And like I say, while we were in a sort of, you know, easy to understand rollout situation, it was exactly the right place to be.
When you look now at what the London stock market is trying to be, the conversations around, you know, the regulations that are there, is it a good place to be to raise your investment right now? Or given how much you're talking about e-commerce, that being online is important to the world of fashion now. Yeah. We've had many, many tech companies look to New York, look elsewhere for stock markets because it's maybe not appreciated, they think, as much in London.
Well, is it the appreciation or is it the fact that there is so much responsibility on directors that they're scared of their own shadows, I think, potentially. And I think, you know, we've got to get to a place where there's sort of more trust in allowing companies to actually run themselves without sort of onerous regulation. And that's my sense.
Are you still keen to take Superdry, you know, fully private for yourself? Are you looking at that?
I think that's the most logical path for us, yes.
And what does that mean then for how the business will look compared to you've delisted from the London Stock Exchange, but your people still sort of able to buy and sell your shares one way or another. But if you were, you know, in charge of the business, owning the business, it was fully private, what would you be doing differently?
Oh, nothing. I think it's just a you know, getting a cost base. Is it right to have a cost base that's as low as it can humanly be when you're in a turnaround situation? Yes, it is. So, I mean, there is a cost still, whether it's audit fees or whatever. Mm-hmm.
So does that mean, just to put almost a timescale, within the next 12 months, will you be making another bid to fully take over the business?
I'm not putting any timescales on it. I think, you know, as a direction of travel, there will be a moment in time that it would become sensible and logical, I think.
A big, slightly changing tack, a big one in the world of retail, particularly when it comes to the London Stock Exchange, is Shein and huge Chinese online fashion, fast fashion retailer that has taken the UK market by storm and many other markets around the world. But here in the UK, shoppers like it on the whole. What do you think of the business being listed in London?
I think the reality, this exposes a real problem with society and government, because what we are doing is allowing a company to ship in goods into this country without paying, I think, no VAT, no import duty, and shipping single parcels from China. So a complete environmental disaster. We're allowing somebody to come in and be a tax avoider, essentially. And then we're potentially going to promote them on the London Stock Exchange when they're undermining, you know, a net zero position. You know, here we are trying as a nation to talk about green energy. In the same breath, we're talking about allowing somebody to list who's an environmental disaster in terms of shipping goods. Also, there are moments in time, and we've seen them before, where large companies find a tax dodge and exploit it fully. Is that what we want as a society? Are we prepared to let some British companies suffer in the hands of inactive government? I think it's sad.
I mean, you call it a tax dodge, but, you know, Shein are playing entirely within the rules.
But the rules weren't made for a company sending individual parcels, having £1 billion turnover in the UK without paying any tax. That's not what the rules were made for. The rules were made for individuals bringing in single parcels to themselves from various places. And I think we've got to understand that the world is changing and we've got to adapt to it very quickly with the principles of a level playing field.
Does that mean the government has to step in here?
Absolutely. 100%.
And do what?
I mean, personally, I would be force them into paying import duty, VAT, and possibly even an environmental tax.
I mean, we've got the budget around the corner. There's an opportunity to do that. What difference would that make to UK retailing if something like that occurred?
Let's take any fashion company that's based in the UK. They are paying import duties when they bring products in from China to resell them in the UK. They are paying VAT at the point of sale, and they're paying rates and income tax on their profits and their properties. So at what point do you say, if I don't have to pay all those, I've obviously got a commercial advantage? Is that the right thing to do as a society? I would suggest not, because ultimately it will undermine your long-term tax take in the UK.
There's a lot of shoppers, though, and we've heard them on our programmes, who clearly use Shein, like what it provides, and may well just be saying, well, you know, of course Superdry wants to make it harder for them because they're not able to do what we want.
It affects me less. So we're not talking about me. What we're talking about is Britain here and a direction of travel. What kind of society do we want? Do we want a tax-paying, efficient business society, or do we want to allow foreign multinationals or international companies to exploit loopholes?
And just finally, Julian, as you talk about sales up at the business and your confidence in Superdry right now sounding like it's in a good place, for the future, for those that have an attachment, have seen the brand over all these decades, what will Superdry look like? Will it still be the Japanese writing, or do you have a different plan for that new generation?
I mean, there's lots of new plans. It's kind of, what are we with? A good strap line somebody came up with the other day is a sort of British heritage, American dream, if you like, where we sort of plunder great fabrics, sort of American ideology, and the Japanese part of our world with the calligraphy and the writing will always be part of our DNA. I mean, it's an important part of our DNA, but actually really it's about fabric and block and how you deliver that branding message. I'm very positive. I mean, our quality is unsurpassed in terms of a branded product on the high street. I mean, unsurpassed.
But if you're aiming for that with your business, as you describe it, compared to others on the high street, that's expensive.
I mean, that's like saying everybody buys the cheapest car on, you know, available. The reality is it's about value. Am I getting a product that is not the same value as the high street is currently offering? Absolutely. So that, you know, the quality of product, you have to look higher, not lower. So there is a longevity with our product. It's, you know, it's slow fashion, if you like.
There's the pitch. Julian Dunkerton, thank you very much. Co-founder and chief executive of Superdry.
Absolute pleasure.
Listening to that was Emma Wall, Head of Investment Analysis and Research at Hargreaves Lansdown. Emma, you know, we've talked Shein before. We'll talk Shein again, the Chinese fast fashion retailer. Listing on the London stock market, should it?
A big question. A lot to unpack from that interview. He definitely didn't hold back, did he? When we first started talking about Shein in June, and it looked like a real likelihood it would list in the London Stock Exchange, my ESG analyst, so that's the environmental, social and governance analysts on my team, definitely were vocal. You know, some facts about Shein. They ship 5,000 tons to the US every single day. There's reports of factory workers enduring 75-hour working weeks. There's linked to the area of China where the Uyghur Muslims are estimated to be in forced labour producing cotton, so they have supply chain links. And for us, it's not to do with whether or not it should list on the London Stock Exchange. It's about investors being acutely aware of the risks of investing in a business like this, because it's not just about whether it's the right thing to do, because scandal can affect the share price. And once you're publicly listed, that scrutiny, you need to look at what happened to Boohoo with some of the issues that happened in the north of England and factories and workers' conditions there. So, I mean, the counter to that is potentially a listing could make the firm more transparent and more accountable to shareholders. At the moment, it's very opaque, and we have a number of both environmental and social and governance concerns about the stock.
Will Corby, Director of Coffee and Social Impact at Pat Coffee. And if you heard Will talking earlier in the programme, you're very aware of the key things that are driving that business at the moment. Will, when you hear what Emma lays out there as some of the concerns with Shein, fast fashion retailer, can it be that actually if we are a little more open to them listing on our stock market, having to tell us every 3 months exactly how the business is doing, that it can actually help improve a business like that? And that should be something we should be encouraging.
Yeah, I think your interview brought up a really interesting juxtaposition between the two businesses, which we're trying to as PACT, to bring together. So that element of quality and longevity being really important to value for consumers, whilst being able to utilise the change in rules, or the change in the way businesses have worked over the past decade, and the changes in supply chain to allow things like businesses to be able to directly move clothing, or in our case coffee, around the world very seamlessly. I can really see a reflection of the values that we have in what Julian's saying, in terms of making sure that we're putting out quality and making sure that in this case the tax is paid on I think running into the £150 million tax is paid on the sales across the UK to go into the government and allow us to do what we need to with that.
Do you feel like in the coffee market, is it a level playing field when you talk about, and I'm conscious about speaking about individual companies, but you know, many of your rivals on the high street will be massive multinational companies from right around the world. These days, are you dealing in the same level playing field as them? They might have the power to, you know, of economies of scale because they're bigger, but other than that,
it's amazing the revolution in the way that international business has changed, and the capacity to be agile over the past 20 years. When I started trading coffee in London 15, 20 years ago, everything we had to do was by fax. You know, we had to have an enormous number of people within supply chains, and nowadays I can control everything to do with our supply chain from home, from my office, very, very easily. I can have a conversation with the 200 farmers we're working with via WhatsApp most days of the week. Mm. It gives me insight beyond what the market is capable of, and the capacity to react is absolutely fantastic. And I think perhaps. What Julian was saying about those shifts in the way the business needs to work, we've all experienced, but there's a huge opportunity there for, I think, all businesses, and it's really exciting. And perhaps Shein are taking those opportunities and using them in a really great way for their growth. And perhaps we need to change some of the taxation rules to ensure that the government can make the most of that. And you know, people aren't necessarily spending more money on clothes, so ensuring they're continuing to capture this tax. It's not really new money in the system.
Yes.
We need to work out a way to continue to capture it.
Interesting. We're going to have to move on very briefly from that, but that's very interesting. Will Corby, who's been with us this morning from Pat Coffee. Just wanted to check in with Dr. Dan Plumley, lecturer in sport finance at Sheffield Hallam University. Morning, Dan.
Good morning, Sean.
Always a bit of a drum roll when I speak to you. But which football club might we be talking about? What controversies are going on? How much money is being spent? Where's the money coming from? This morning, it's Everton Football Club and the American investment group, the Friedkin Group, owns the Italian side Roma as well, agreeing a deal to own almost all of the club. Needs to be a few I's dotted and T's crossed from the Premier League, the Football Association, the financial regulators as well. What about this move?
Yeah, really interesting one, isn't it? Given a few months ago that takeover was there and then fell through, partly because we were led to believe that they'd not been happy with some of the financial money that was owed out to other parties. So again, never say never in takeovers, I suppose. Never say never in football takeovers. And perhaps, yeah, surprising to see it come back around maybe so quickly, but it seems they've been interested as well. And of course, they've got money in the stadium. So yeah, I mean, as you say, still formalities and checks to be completed, but seems a really bit of positive news this morning for Everton fans to wake up to.
So it feels like it'd be a straightforward one for you, because at the moment the conversation is often around who exactly is this person, perhaps a little bit more than it used to be.
Yeah, and we know the details of that one, don't we, from before as well. And we know they've invested in other sports properties. We know the connections with Roma. They are kind of tried and tested in the football market. So that kind of alleviates some of those concerns. And as we said, they were in and around the takeover 6 months ago, only for it to then change at the last minute. So this is probably looks to be, from the outside looking in, as we can see right now, yes, just more of a case of the formalities. Those things can still take a little bit of time, maybe expect a few weeks. But if this is the deal that we think it is, then we could be nearly at the end of this takeover saga for the club.
And so end of the takeover saga, but does it necessarily change the financial situation at Everton that was, getting those high profile points deductions last year because its finances were such a mess? There's question marks over the money for the stadium. There has been as well. Will these new owners come in? Are they willing to put all the money in that just sorts all of that out, or will the struggles continue?
There seems to be some equity going in, as that's the suggestions that we've seen and some of the numbers. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't change the situation overnight. And I've often said with this takeover in particular, you are dealing with, as you say, a lot of the hangover from the previous few years and a lot of worries with the finances and the points deduction. There's a lot of potential further forward with the new stadium once that gets up and running. And yes, that's got to pay back in the short to medium term, but then it can really generate you some revenue in the long term. So you can see why they're invested in Everton Football Club, as a proposition. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Sean. It will take a few years and this has to now be looked at as the medium to long-term plan for the football club, not a quick fix.
What can you tell us about Dan Friedkin, the chairman, the person behind this?
Yeah, as I said, there is a football connection. Most people will be aware of his ownership of Roma and the success that they've had actually in the last few years as well. But he's in to a lot of other investments into, luxury hotels and boutiques. And there's a lot of kind of behind him and that group as a, investing in lots of assets and different businesses and industries around the world. So, yeah, I guess he comes with a tried and tested reputation in football terms, which is always the big tick in the box if you're looking at him taking over your particular club. And yeah, fairly wealthy and powerful investor in a lot of different markets as well.
Dan, thanks very much. Dr. Dan Plumley there from Sheffield Hallam University. Emma, just before we wrap up, Nationwide to offer first-time buyers loans of up to 6 times their income. Battle for mortgage customers. Is that the right thing for Nationwide to be doing? 6 times your income?
It's definitely a vote of confidence, not just in the individuals they're lending to, but also to the yield curve. So what's expectations for interest rates to fall, and indeed in the UK economy, because what you're betting on then is first time buyers continuing to have an income, continuing to have a job, continuing to be financially stable enough to pay those mortgage payments. So Nationwide does say that there'll be quite strict affordability criteria and every assessment must be done on every individual. So it's not a blanket offer, but it's definitely a vote of confidence, I'd say, in the UK.
What's the downside? I mean, I'm thinking 6 times your income. If some of those things don't happen, if your income doesn't go up, you have a change in life, experiences, interest rates move.
Yeah, I mean, it's default risk, obviously. You know, if individuals, if we go into a recession, if there's job squeezes, if there's wage freezes, all of these things can impact people's ability to pay mortgages. And so, therefore, would be a risk nationwide, yeah.
Emma, thanks so much. Emma Waugh from Hargreaves Lansdown. Big thanks to Will Corby from Pat Coffee and everybody who's been on Wake Up to Money getting in touch this morning. That's it from us. Breakfast up next with Rachel and Claire. Good morning, both.
Thank you, Sean. Morning. Morning, everyone. Coming up on Five Live Breakfast, Keir Starmer is addressing the Labour conference for the first time as Prime Minister.
There has been a big rise in the number of e-bikes being seized by police.
And are In My Opinion today, most school homework is rubbish. It's either too short or too long or inappropriate or doesn't teach kids anything. So how would you do it?
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Let's take you through the main news stories today then. Sir Keir Starmer will warn of short-term pain but promise long-term gain when he makes his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister later. He'll say there are no easy answers and will call on people to join a shared struggle as the government tries to build a new Britain. Our political correspondent Ian Watson in Liverpool says Sir Keir will talk about light at the end of the tunnel.
I think the worry that some delegates have, and certainly some of the trade unions, is just how long is that tunnel going to be before they reach the promised land. So I think what he's going to try and do is give a glimpse of where he wants to get to, a country with greater economic growth, greater investment. There'll be a smattering of specific policies, I think, around skills, for example. And he'll be saying more on welfare reform because he has to obviously identify savings in the budget in order to put investment elsewhere.
Thousands of people in southern Lebanon have fled their homes after Israeli airstrikes killed almost 500 people in the deadliest day of cross-border conflict with Hezbollah in 20 years. Roads heading north were blocked with traffic as civilians headed for safer areas. The Israeli military says it's hit around 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanese authorities say most of the sites were residential. Daniel Hagari is a spokesman for the Israeli military.
Regarding the high number of casualties, everyone is a tragedy in Lebanon. Among those killed were a large number of Hezbollah terrorists who were next to the weapons that we targeted. Israel is facing threats on all fronts and continuing to act against them in defense for the people of Israel.
The number of illegally modified electric bikes confiscated by UK police forces rose significantly in the last year. 27 of 46 forces responded to a Freedom of Information request by the Press Association. More than 900 illegal e-bikes were seized compared to 511 for the previous 12 months.
A senior executive from the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike will be questioned by a US congressional committee.